talking about their careers, and stoked to have Tom Larkin on the phone from Melbourne. How are you, Tom?
I'm good, mate. How are you, Ricardo?
Yeah, good, mate. A little birdie tells me you guys are recording a new record right now.
We're not actually recording it right now. We've just had to change plans in order how we're going to do it. We haven't actually quite resolved that yet.
Right.
It's one of those sideways things life throws at you. So, yeah, no, we have about 52 tracks kind of in a demo state. So we're just trying to find the right situation to get them recorded.
Nice. Now, 52 tracks. Are we looking at Use Your Illusions 3 and 4? Or shit, I've never done
an
album.
No. I reckon any amount of songs past 11, although we have gone that far, tends to just be annoying.
For you or for people listening?
For people listening and to record it.
Sweet, mate. All good. Well, yeah, obviously, you're in Melbourne. You're on the phone. We'll get you to stay there, mate. We're going to play a couple of tracks. I don't know what... your favourites are from your early days, but Screwtop's always been one of mine.
Yeah, no, Screwtop's a great one.
And is there a bit of, what's the story behind Screwtop?
Oh, it was basically John went out one night, took a few things, and it changed his brain permanently, and took him a wee while to recover. And so that was him writing it about what happened
about
that night. I think it was kind of, if there was any tipping point from John turning in from a teenager into an adult, that was what he was writing about.
Excellent. Well, we'll give that one a spin. We'll come back and keep talking to Tom Larkin all about his experiences with Shehead, surely. Tom, when you were around recording, like in some of the earlier days of Shehead, obviously it was, you know, technology's changed a lot from then to what it is now. How did you find it? Because I remember being in a band sort of around the early 90s and going, man, it was expensive to try and secure a studio and record, and, you know, you had to pay for the tape and everything back then. What were your experiences, early experiences like?
Well, that was kind of it. You know, you'd spend a huge amount of money for a small amount of time. So what it meant was that the pressure was on you to make it sound good. Because, I mean, I think that's what's missing these days. A lot of bands, you know, are so used to leaning on computer manipulation, that you miss that kind of what I would call, you know, what was high at that point, a highly competitive kind of, you know, group of musicians at that time. You know, you had to be, if you couldn't make it sound good yourself, you couldn't record. That was kind of the deal, at least of the kind of stuff we were doing. I think that's what made you kind of like, the emphasis was on much more on delivery and rehearsal and musicianship and being tight and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, we recorded our first EP in like, you know, 3 days and nights, worked every minute.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Churn was recorded in 2 weeks. Killjoy was recorded in 3.
Right.
You know, it was, and those were kind of longer projects at the time. You know, and it was, you just had to deliver fast. But I think that gives you something. I mean, you know, for what you burned there, that was one of those things where you were constantly kind of overdubbing and looking for new ideas, but you were doing it all very fast. And even in the mixing thing, you know, there was, the band helped mix that song where, you know, there's a part there where Carl's bass kind of rises up, and that, you know, one of the EQ knobs being marked out and the kind of how far it's going to go up and how far it's going to come down is given to Carl to turn up and turn down at certain points, that jumps out of the mix. All that kind of stuff used to happen, you know. It was like this fully organic, people would do stuff.
Yeah, you hear stories too from back in the day, and I'm talking, you know, like watching the Sound City documentary and, you know, going even back into the 70s and things, and you know, there's some happy accidents happen in the studio because that's the way you used to work.
Well, I think that's it. It's because a computer allows you to become so rigid these days, and you know, that I've come to kind of feel like that the sound of perfection and things sounding very in tune and very perfectly in time and, you know, gridded and sample replaced is actually the sound of bedroom demos now.
They actually, you know, sound better than proper recording.
Yeah, well, the point being is that, you know, if you've got a band in a room that's playing live, it's the sound of a band that's actually got enough budget to go into a real studio. You know what I mean? And that's the difference. I mean, you can make everything sound perfect. It's kind of like, you know, I remember when we did General Electric, you know, that was the kind of, that's when we did everything, you know, the way that you can do it to a computer now, but we did it to tape.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was frightfully expensive. I mean, that album cost $250,000. And you can get the same sound now, you know, by, you know, going and recording some drums and then sitting in your bedroom and using a whole bunch of plugins and amp simulators, you know what I mean? It won't be the exact same sound, of course, but you can get the same kind of production aesthetic, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. You know what I mean? It does, yeah.
But you cannot replicate an album like Killjoy in a bedroom environment, because it's a band through a console that has a tone and it's very live, and you cannot do that. You have to be able to perform it, and that's what makes the difference.
Because you not only produce bands, but you manage a couple of bands as well. And is that something that you talk to them about and say, look, you guys just need to go out and play and play and play and play and play, and let's get this tight and let's record it live?
Yeah, no. I mean, that's definitely come about. I mean, I think younger bands are in a position sometimes where they can't do that live. Yep. And can't do that recording-wise. So it has to be done differently. And also, there's also certain kinds of bands where their style, you know, just does not permit that to happen. You know what I mean? There's certain bands with aesthetics where you just have to do it differently. But for the most part, if you're talking a rock band, you know, if they're good enough, getting them to record live is the best way to go. And the other thing is that live recordings of bands tend to be timeless, or recordings that are based around live performances. You know, they tend to age far better, you know, because they're not so kind of like dialed into technology. They tend to kind of, you can go back to them and they don't kind of freak you out with their obnoxious production. You know what I mean?
Yeah, mate. Yeah. Now, you guys obviously worked on, or, you know, you did the Devolve EP, and I saw you guys open for Motorhead at the Town Hall off the back of that and play it live, which was amazing. And then not long after that, you got in with Jazz Coleman to record Churn. How did the meeting with Jazz Coleman come about and working with him?
Well, I mean, I think he'd moved to New Zealand. I think it was basically the guy we'd worked with, Malcolm Wellsford, who was one of the owners at the time of York Street, had run into this guy. And Malcolm was chasing us, and we were kind of like fobbing him off because we weren't really keen on working with Malcolm. And I think our manager at the time was very, very unkeen on working with Malcolm.
Right.
And what happened then was that Jazz got in touch, and I think he kind of introduced the band to Jazz, and Jazz then wanted to meet us and kind of wanted to do a New Zealand band. It was kind of like the timing was right. But I think, you know, that first meeting, you know, for us, we'd loved Killing Joke growing up. You know, definitely one of my kind of hero artists. And the first meeting was great, and then we did the album with them, and it was, look, I mean, the thing is that Jazz Coleman is, you know, has many, many flaws, and I think that they're kind of like ones that are explored fairly extensively. Mm. But I think the real thing is that what he brought to the band at the time was astonishing. And, you know, when I say Jazz got many, many flaws, well, so the fuck do we.
Yeah.
but the thing was that he really was a producer, and there was, at the time there were very few producers in New Zealand. There still seem to be very few producers around in Australasia, because as soon as they are a producer, they piss off to the Northern Hemisphere.
Mm.
And, you know, to me, that is someone who doesn't just kind of look after the sonics of things. It's someone who examines, you know, the songs, the kind of the manifesto of the act, the lyrics, the delivery, the kind of the whys, the wherefores, and, you know, it brings an extra dimension to it. I think too many people sit in front of a console and can operate plugins and chop things up and mix things, and they're called a producer, and they're not. You know what I mean?
No, they're an engineer.
They're an engineer or a mixer. They're a technician. A producer is someone who should have an idea of how something should be. Like, for instance, for me, I have this weird little problem that if I like a band too much, I don't do a very good job producing them.
Right.
Because it doesn't fire the kind of like, hey, this should go this way before I do it. You know what I mean? It doesn't fire up all the kind of producer kind of like corners of my mind. I don't get into that production mode because I just stand there in awe and kind of go, oh, I just really like this. I can't see anything wrong with it. And of course, somebody else can. You know what I mean? But that's really the kind of thing for me, is I find that I have to hear something where I can hear enough of what I love about it, but I've also got to hear stuff where I feel it's not quite sitting right for me to actually start to imagine it in a different way. And that's what you bring to the table as a producer.
Working with Jazz, that, I mean, that short time, and obviously, you know, it was pretty up and down, a bit of a roller coaster for both parties. But what did you take away from that you maybe still use now as a producer?
Oh, so many things. You know, the one thing about, you know, how he would always talk about the kind of the energy, the kind of, he called it the white heat, but that's this kind of level of energy that you need to get to kind of achieve that kind of, I mean, you know, transcendence, really. And he was very big on the whole, you know, communal energy and focus. All those kind of things were massive. He'd also explore the lyrics. He also did, you know, just song structures and how he would, you know, produce the way a song would go and work with the kind of, not only the structures, but the arrangement of it, when to shut things down, when to turn things on, you know, all that kind of stuff. He was very good at kind of metering the drama of a track. He was attuned to that, and you know, it wouldn't be a conscious thing, he'd just be doing it, and you realize later how good he was at, you know, and he's, you know, obviously he's a composer and an orchestrator as well. He was incredibly good at orchestrating what we were doing for Impact, and so he was great like that, you know. And his personality, you know, he had an abandon, you know, and an irreverence of certain things that was really helpful for us to be, you know, kind of uptight and metal orientated as we were,
yeah,
you know, to kind of be told to, you know, like, I mean, there's one fill at the end of Screwtop. I fuck it up. You hear it. It's actually wrong. And he wouldn't let me change it. He wouldn't let me fix it. And now I love that. You know what I mean?
it's that own little signature of yours. Goes back to that thing, not everything being perfect.
So, you know, it was encouraging us to push out of those kind of comfort zones of, you know, being those kind of musicians who are really practiced and schooled. And, you know, he kind of took that out of us and went for guts and kind of instinct and, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And I think that was a huge part of it. There's a hell of a lot jazz taught us. And he couldn't have been more well suited for that first album.
Awesome, awesome. Well, I'm going to play Derail now, mate. Is there anything we should be listening out for on this one?
No, not really. It's a cracker track. I love that song. Love the rhythm of it.
Tom, we've been talking about some of the early days, you know, working with Jazz Coleman of Killing Joke, obviously, on Churn, and then you followed that up with Killjoy. And Killjoy was an album that opened a few doors for you. You ended up on tour through Europe with Faith No More. Mike Borden was a bit of a fan, wasn't he?
We actually did two tours of Judy in Europe with them. And, yeah, I mean, that was really our first kind of turn. You know, that album really kind of turned our career, that one. And I think it was an interesting one because we kind of fell out with Jazz over that album, and you know, the kind of the interpretations were different, but the honest truth of the matter was he was away overseas, we were trying to get in touch with him, and we couldn't get in touch with him, and we were ready to go, and so we went, oh fuck it, we're just doing it. That's what came out, and I think one of the things that kind of came back into the She-Hud thing that naturally kind of came out was this kind of more rock and roll kind of aspect to the band. There was a kind of a much more rock thing. The other thing that we did is that we found, and I think part of it was to do with the fact that I'd, A, worked with Killing Joke in the studio, and their guitarist had introduced me to these old 59 Fender basements, which are these old combo amps that Fender made that are really the kind of like Rosetta Stone for every other amp after Rare nowadays. But he had them, and we'd located one in Auckland, and we basically went up and used this amp for all the guitars, and it was completely an unusual move for a band at the time to use an amp like that. The other thing was we found a hollow body bass for Carl, and you know, drums for me, like 26 inch kick drums, the whole Bonham thing,
right?
And so all of that went together, and we're kind of using instruments that were quote unquote wrong and also very, very different from the Churn era, to kind of produce it. And it gave you this vintage old rock and roll sound with a modern band playing through it. And that was actually, you know, a lot of times when you look at bands from that era, say like a Pearl Jam or a Stone Temple Pilots, they were kind of like doing a lot of old vintage kind of chord shapes and kind of doing that whole, you know, Neil Young-esque updated. And we weren't at all. We were a very modern band, modern chords, modern structures, modern kind of beats and all that kind of stuff, but through this entirely vintage setup. And it gave that album a completely unique tone. It made it sound very rock and roll, but very unusual at the same time.
Yeah, because Deb's Night Out, it's not, I guess, what you'd call a typical single-sounding song, but that really, I guess, was the song that broke you off that album.
Well, yeah, I mean, there was a couple there. I mean, You Again was a big one for us as well.
Yeah.
But, you know, like Deb's Night Out, for instance, you know, that was like a drum loop. And the drum loop was on a piece of tape. And, like, when I say that was on a piece of tape, the way we recorded it is that there was a piece of tape being held with a drumstick, like a loop with the beat on it, just edited and put together with sellotape, and just held the drumstick out, you know, and just recorded that loop back in. And that's what the drums are. You know what I mean? It's just, it was so many stupid little things going on like that at the time. And the whole album is just murdered. Like, everything is just fucking distorted and crushed into oblivion
but in a good way.
Yeah, you know, it was certainly a classic album, a classic New Zealand album, and kind of for its time, I mean, that album, while it was probably done on a fraction of the budget, was up there with anything that was being produced overseas at the time. And I guess, is that how you kind of got on with Faith No More? How did they end up hooking up with you guys?
Well, again, you know, it was that kind of Killing Joke connection where Faith No More were playing in town on the Angel Dust tour. And all the guys in Killing Joke and anyone working with them were invited down to the studio, down to see the show. I just happened to be a huge Faith No More fan. So I went up to Mike at the end of the night, Mike Borden, and just said, oh, by the way, you know, we're from Killing Joke, da-da-da-da. And all of a sudden, this fucking conversation between us about, you know, what Killing Joke was and what it meant to him and everything like that just erupted. And then before you knew it, I had Billy Gould, Mike Borden and Mike Patton in the back of my Volvo. and their tour manager in the back of my mother's Volvo, actually, which I'd borrowed to drive up to Auckland. And I drove them to the studio and where they met Jazz. And as they were meeting Jazz, Malcolm, the engineer, decided to play them, oh, you know, do you want to hear his band? And played them Churn. And I just remember coming in and they were just going, holy fuck, this album's incredible.
Awesome.
So when they went back to the States, they got in touch going, we fucking love your band. And then they offered us the full King for a Day tour in the UK.
Mate, that is magical. Do you have a favourite like tour story from touring with Faith No More? I mean, you know, Mike Patton's got a reputation for being a bit of a crazy cat at times.
Oh, look, Mike was always incredibly respectful to us. I always remember when we were, you know, doing the name change thing. Mike was, you know, bailed me up in a bar and told me he was going to kill me if we went ahead with it. I should have listened. I suppose there was one night where we were fucking, I was like, there's about 4,000 people in a place in Germany and they're playing. And it was one of their kind of like slower numbers.
Yeah.
It might have been Take This Bottle. I can't even remember. One of their slower, or maybe it was Even Easy. You know, sitting behind watching Borden do his thing because he's always been one of my favorite drummers ever. And, you know, the rest of the band standing around. Then all of a sudden, Borden just turns around, hands me the sticks and goes, there you go, in one of the breaks.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what the fuck? He goes, go. I'm not playing it. You have to save the ship. So I ended up behind his kit, which is a tough kit to play because it's completely left-handed and I'm right-handed. So yeah. I was like around the wrong way. So I'm playing the kit. I'm playing the song in front of 4,000 people. And kind of Billy Gould turns around, looks at me and goes, what the fuck are you doing behind
that shit? quality. And have you got a favorite Faith No More song that we can play now?
I always liked From Out of Nowhere. I thought that was one of the turning point songs. But all the stuff on the album beforehand as well, you know. Introduce Yourself, that was fantastic. As the Worm Turns. No, but yeah, I mean, From Out of Nowhere, killer.
You guys did move to the States and spent a bit of time in LA. How crazy was living in LA, like for a boy from New Zealand going over there?
Oh, look, what was weird about LA is that we kind of got used to it. After you get used to it, lived there for about a year, you're really warm to it. I mean, I still like LA. I still like how it is. I mean, it's a really strange place. Like the industry side of it is really weird. I think that you can get lost in it, and I certainly think that that's what happened to our band. But at the same time, if you can keep your head together, you can actually own it. If you've got the spotlight of, you know, LA turning on you, and you can kind of keep your shit together and play it for what it is, you can actually, you know, you can own it and, you know, not lose your shit when it happens. But, you know, LA for us, we stayed, you know, we stayed in this apartment complex called the Oakwoods, kind of lived there for ages. You know, we were basically recording for 8 months while we were there most of the time, and we got to basically know every decent taco joint in the whole place. you know, what I mean, there are plenty of crazy things that kind of went on. I mean, you know, from kind of ending up in those kind of 6 o'clock in the morning on the balcony, having done too much of whatever with various people, you know, kind of several nights of that. And then, you know, and then also just the kind of like the straight up weirdness of LA. Like there was this one guy, you know, just before we kind of did the first kind of Pacifier show, we get introduced to this guy that the labels brought in. This guy's job is just to connect us with Hollywood celebrities. And it's like he's paid to do it. He's paid to put on parties and invite you.
Wow.
You know, to sit down and have lunch, you know, on Sunday with this guy from that label and this guy who's, you know, who sings songs for films and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And then he's got a party with Tuya Ramirez and Manson's band and all this shit. And he's paid to connect you and all these things.
Yeah. I thought he might have, mate. Now, you guys obviously working on a new record. I've heard the word about the new record and the writing process of it, that this is going to be heavier and darker and maybe a throwback, I guess, to Love Is the New Hate, maybe more that style of record?
Look, I mean, the thing is, like, it's too early to tell. You know, we've done a lot of stuff recently, and, you know, the thing is that until we hear the vocals and we understand where the songs are at, we're going to be, you know, it hasn't really got a direction, but it is kind of, it's pretty heavy.
Yeah. Pretty heavy is good. And obviously, you know, Love Is the New Hate was I thought, a record that didn't get the recognition that it deserved. Do you want to give us a quick rundown on what this All The Young Fascists is about and when you were touring the States?
Oh, look, we played a festival in Miami. It was a radio festival, and it was all these bands like, you know, Trapped and, you know, Disturbed and all this kind of stuff. And it was this big radio festival, middle of Miami, actually fucking beautiful, beautiful setup. But we turned up, and as we, you know, when we signed on to the festival, by the time we turned up, within, you know, kind of like a week out, they changed the theme because they just invaded Iraq. They changed the theme into, you know, this whole USO support the troops. And, you know, it was kind of like all of a sudden all these bands were going, you know, let's turn Baghdad into a car park and let's, you know, they were like they were cheering for the idea of flattening Iraq.
Wow.
And it was really weird because at the same time, this was a USO support the troops thing. And so we were going on between all these bands who were basically, you know, expressing a lot of joy at the idea of, you know, the decimation of Iraq and no idea of the sensitivity of the thing. And much least of all, the kind of the idea that there were going to be thousands and thousands of, you know, killed and injured people coming out of the whole thing.
Mm.
Except for the USO. And the USO are really interesting because, I'll get back to them in a minute, because the other thing that started going around is that then you had all this kind of crazy redneck paraphernalia going on where it was like, you know, paintball gun alley,
yeah,
you know, where you could shoot Osama bin Laden, Saddam Hussein, or Jacques Chirac, president of France, because the French were against it all, you know what I mean? So
yeah.
He was, you know, it was like you've got a crowd of, you know, people, you know, going, fuck France, yeah, France are a bunch of, you know, like a bunch of terrorists too, and just this massive sea of ignorance. And it was just like this whole festival was pumping up every dumb slogan you could possibly imagine. And it was just so dumb and ignorant, the way they were thinking of it all. And we were just sitting there going, no, you don't understand. This whole Iraq thing's a cul-de-sac. You're going to just be in there for years. It's a waste of time. There are no weapons of mass destruction. I mean, it was obvious to us.
Yeah.
You know, but the amount of times a soundbite gets turned into, you know, a manifesto for a nation in that world, it's just crazy. So when we were watching all that stuff, we were just going, this is the building blocks of fascism. This is how Germany could have happened. You know what I mean? This rampant nationalism with a slogan and enough bullshit around it, this is what happens. And, you know, I think you could transpose that anywhere. You know what I mean? And the thing was, it was not so much that it was the United States in that particular situation. That was merely our situation to witness. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was really All The Young Fascists about how that stuff happens. You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally.
And the next thing was, of course, that when we actually managed to talk to the USO, who were the chief sponsors, like the head of the USO, who was there, was expressing almost exactly the same stuff as us, just basically going, this is unbelievable because these kids do not understand they're cheering for something that's just going to break people's lives.
Mm.
And we're actually an organization that helps broken people, you know, and these people are cheering for it. And that's not what we do. That's not what we're about.
Yeah, support our troops is about supporting the guys that come home and rebuild their lives afterwards.
Kind of. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tom, thanks for your time today, mate. It's been fantastic.
No problem, Regatta.
Now we're just going to finish off with a quick fire five questions just to get to know you just a wee bit better, mate. So first up, Ford or Holden?
I'm going to have to go Ford.
Ford? All right.
Yeah. But any reason? You know what the actual answer is?
What's the actual answer?
Toyota.
Oh, there you go. That's all right, mate. If you asked me that question, the actual answer would have to be Mitsubishi, but nobody really wants to hear that.
You know what? I've owned four Fords.
Yeah.
And I've just gone, despite the fact that they make, you know, kind of fun cars, both Ford and Holden.
Yeah.
I just go,
after 50,000 Ks, they catch a flu. You know, it's just like, and I just got tired of driving a car that I thought was a good idea, but just would not start, or just, I drive Toyotas now, and, you know, they're a bit more boring, but my God, they start every day.
That's all you can ask, mate. Rugby or league?
Oh, that's just, you know, not fair. Wow. League.
And who's your team?
Warriors.
Warriors, right. Okay, good, good, good. You haven't converted to the Storm just yet?
No. I mean, I love watching the Storm. I think they're great, but no.
Warriors boy. All right, breakfast. Do you roll hot or cold? What are you hitting in the morning?
I'm more a hot guy.
More of a hot guy?
Yeah.
All right.
Cooked.
Sabbath or Motorhead?
Ah, what are you doing to me? Sabbath.
Sabbath, done. And what's your poison these days, mate? What's your go-to?
Let me see. Oh, look, I'm actually a fairly simple man. I'm a fan of the lager. Just a good few lagers, and I'm a happy man.
So if you're back home in New Zealand, what are you rolling?
Oh, Monteith Golden.
Monteith Golden?
Yep.
Boom. We're that much closer to knowing more about you, mate.
Excellent.
Hey, Tom, thanks very much for your time today, bro. I really appreciate it. And good luck with the writing of the new record, and look forward to hopefully seeing you in New Zealand at sometime in the near future.
All right, mate. Thanks, Ricardo.
Hey, cheers, bro.
See you soon. Bye-bye.
Cheers.